Hello, my name is Kanishka Rathore. Welcome to Future of Cities podcast. The main aim of Future of Cities is to raise open questions on urban future and steer discussions on what the future of cities can and should be. We regularly host fireside chats, deep dive with experts, and panel discussions on Clubhouse. Today we will be discussing nature-based solutions for urban resilience. Our guest is Sami Wabha. Welcome, Sami. Would you like to briefly introduce yourself and let us know how World Bank works with cities?
Thanks a lot, Kanishka, and good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you might be. My name is Sami Wabha. I'm the Global Director for Urban Development, Disaster Risk Management, Resilience and Land at the World Bank. I lead a global practice that has about 400 staff working on these issues. We've got a large portfolio in about 140 countries, some 250 to 300 projects. That is with the equivalent of $30 billion in investments and basically loans and grants for a range of issues involving cities, disaster risk management, and land and property rights. So on cities, we are particularly active. We work on a range of issues on cities. In general, our approach is to help governments, both at national level and local level, because at national level, you've got, if you will, the ministries of finance and of urban development, etc., that have a role, together with mayors and local government to build cities that are inclusive, green, resilient, and competitive at the same time. So it's, if you will, all the ingredients of building sustainable cities for all.
Thank you very much for introducing what you do at the World Bank and how World Bank is working and providing support to cities. What are nature-based solutions? Would you like to share with us how you define it and why are they important for cities?
Thanks. So nature-based solutions are basically investments in nature that are aimed at targeting specific problems within cities. So usually these types of problems would be about how to improve overall well-being, the livability of a city, how to make the environment feel more comfortable, more secure in terms of the built environment. It involves dimensions related from protection from flooding and other disasters, including landslides. Protection from extreme heat and other climate risks, but also all, if you will, the dimensions of well-being and livability that emerge from having such nature-based solutions, you know, your enjoyment of parks, open spaces, water bodies, etc., contribute to, if you will, the an improved livability of the city and both better physical and mental well-being. So it's the range of these solutions that are being applied, and they usually involve, if you will, I mean, the whole gamut of nature, which is, if you want, the sum total of all your plant, animal, but also fungal and microbial life that you'll find within a city. Lots of, you know, blue spaces, green spaces, and if you will, all the contributors of urban biodiversity to make those cities livable, resilient, and green. Now, these have been before, if you want, I mean, they've always been out there, but I don't think they had really acquired prominence for a variety of reasons. And I think the past few years, and especially now, as we head towards, if you will, the joint COPs, you know, the COP on climate change in Glasgow and the COP on biodiversity, I think we're starting, and especially in a post-COVID context, you know, which is a combination of it being a zoonotic disease that has emerged within an urban context and therefore, you know, sits at somewhat at this intersection of urban development, urbanization, and nature, but also with the lockdowns, I mean, really, cities have fared very, very differently in terms of their ability to cope with the impact of COVID-19 to offer a livable and secure and safe built environment in many ways on account of the way they have treated nature, integrated it, or, if you will, taken a toll of it.
Thank you very much, Sami. Indeed, I mean, as you said, the pandemic as well as the climate change and related disasters threaten our ecosystems, cities, and people at a growing pace. So according to you, what are the benefits of nature-based solutions to resolve them in comparison with the classical infrastructure-based solutions? So for example, how do we balance between this green infrastructure or nature-based solutions versus the gray infrastructure or the traditional infrastructure-based solutions?
So, I mean, nature-based solutions basically bring a tremendous amount of benefits to cities. So, you know, and multiple benefits at the same time. So on the one hand, you've got things like whether it's street trees or, you know, rivers or wetlands. I mean, these all could help, you know, in cooling the air and would have a significant effect in mitigating urban heat island effect. I mean, you know, got cities like Singapore and others that have, you know, taken important measures towards, you know, reducing the impact of extreme heat. You know, urban green spaces, as I mentioned, can improve the livability. And again, I mean, their impacts as far as temperatures are massive. And just to give you an example, those of you who might have visited the city of Seoul in South Korea will probably have come across a place called the Cheonggicheong Stream. This used to be a stream up until the 40s or the 50s. It was a very neglected stream with, like, you know, sewage ridden, etc. And then by the 60s, 70s, a multi-lane elevated highway was built on it. So the stream was covered and it was transformed into an elevated highway. And then, you know, in this past decade, this highway was dismantled and the stream was restored. And just by virtue of reintroducing the stream with, if you will, the public spaces and the you know, restoring the vegetation and the water flow, I mean, just micro temperatures in that area dropped by 3 to 5 degrees Celsius. And strangely enough, removing a highway that carried a capacity at peak of 180,000 cars per hour did not actually result in, you know, deteriorating conditions of congestion. On the contrary, I mean, traffic got diverted, rearranged, and actually in that specific area, traffic conditions have actually even improved. Obviously, both demand and supply type responses. You've got also important impacts of having, you know, green areas, vegetated areas, whether alongside, you know, ground surface or on rooftops. All these greenery allows water, you know, to both penetrate into the ground or to be absorbed, and thereby they reduce flooding or downstream pollution. They can increase the recharge of the groundwater resources. If you will, in coastal cities, you know, preserving, you know, the mangroves, the seagrass beds, the coral reefs, and the like, and also beaches can help protect the city from coastal zone erosion, and if you will, increase sea level rise and flooding that may occur also as a result of climate change. And we spoke about, if you will, the importance of the benefits that emerge also from both the livability, but also the mitigating impact on climate change, you know, especially as you can store and sequester carbon more. Now, in response to your other question as to why, you know, whether, you know, it's green or gray or green and gray, I think there are two dimensions to this question. One, green infrastructure, nature-based solutions have proven to be, if you will, as effective, if not more effective at times in certain functions, you know, like the containment of floods, etc., than the gray infrastructure. And of course, if you will, they're much cheaper to build and, you know, they're much easier, if you want, to maintain in their natural status. So green solutions have proven to be, very effective as opposed to gray solutions in certain conditions. But oftentimes you need to combine both. It's not an either or. It's oftentimes, it's gray and green. So when you're talking about urban flood management, just thinking about urban flood retention areas alone is not going to be enough. I mean, they're important. They'll store the storm water. They'll reduce the requirements for draining and pumping, but you still need the gray infrastructure. You need the storm drains, the pumps, the outfalls, and it's together with those two that you create a system of gray and green infrastructure. The same applies, if you think about water supply and sanitation, you need your reservoirs, your treatment plants, your pipe network amongst the gray infrastructure, but you still need to couple that with, the watersheds and the wetlands, watersheds that help you improve the source water quality, and therefore you reduce the requirements to treat, and the wetlands as well. They filter the wastewater effluent, and therefore they reduce the treatment requirements. So I think when you thoughtfully think about gray and green infrastructure together, you end up with solutions that are really interesting and integrated.
Thank you very much, Sami. Indeed, I mean, as you said, it has multiple benefits. Not only some of the nature-based solutions, as you said, helps in mitigating disaster, avoiding disasters such as floods, etc. It also helps in, addressing climate risks or even pollution, for example. And good that you mentioned also this water and stormwater management issue. I was also watching this video as part of preparation for this room, and I saw that. I mean, it's evident. We just don't pay so much attention. Most of the cities in the global south, they don't have proper stormwater management. And what happens in case of course, when there is too much of rainfall and its stormwater management system is not good, most of the waste which is on the street, which are made of asphalt, goes into the stormwater drains and so on to the sewer. And of course, that then eventually ends up in one way or another to a water body, may it be a lake or it be a river and so on, which again has, worse effects. For example, it pollutes the river or a lake, affects the fishes there. Then, when people consume those fishes and so on, then they get diseases and so on. So you can see how if you don't manage a problem, it has effects in from one way to another. And what I saw is that it's nature has such a has shown us how it can help us in solving this issue just by a simple solution, which is like everyone has plants, and when we put water, no matter how polluted it is in the soil, nature has a way to take away, to absorb the water, but all the waste stays on top. And then what they have done in some cities is that they have directed the storm water towards a small island of where they have put boulders and planted some trees and so on. And this water goes through that area. It ended up in the period of 5 to 6 years creating a small urban forest, which of course has benefits from our climate point of view and addressing the urban heat island issues and so on. But on the other side, it filters the water in a way, and then this water goes to the water body, and it's as simple as that. So, nature based solutions like this have great potential, I think, in cities around the world. But that brings me to my third question. I mean, it does look like very logical to have and to implement such nature based solutions, but at least to me, I have not seen so many. So my question is about the barrier. So why do you think the cities all over the world are not able to propagate or implement these kind of solutions? Are there still significant gaps in research? Is it more about lack of awareness, or is there a need for more information sharing or peer-to-peer learning? What are the major barriers which is stopping us from adopting these solutions?
Thanks, Kanishka. I think in general, I think there are two types of barriers. I think one of them has to do with, if you will, maybe an incomplete understanding of the potential benefits of nature-based solution, and the other is obviously related to political economy considerations. So on the understanding of the economic impacts of nature-based solution, I think, again, I'm not a foremost expert in the field. It's not like I know all the literature, but my understanding, the real interest and the accentuation of the literature on the field is a real byproduct of the past 4 or 5 years. And again, within the environment practice, there's been quite a bit of attention to issues of nature-based solutions, but within the urban practice, city leaders, mayors, etc., less exposure to this. But I think, if you will, one of your seminal pieces, so at the bank, we've had a publication called The Changing Wealth of Nations, and before it, work on what you call WAVES, which is Wealth Accounting and Valuation of Ecosystems Services. And those two, if you will, lines of publications started drawing attention to the important economic benefits that emerge from nature-based solutions. In general, on landscapes, if you want, whether they're related to health, productivity, environmental, climate change impact. But I think within the urban practice, I mean, we did 4 years back a study on three, if you will, ecosystem services in Africa. It was one really of the first reports that I have ever treated that, which is a wetland. One is a citywide system in the city of Durban, which is one of the few cities in Africa that really valorize nature to its full extent. So a citywide approach, and then the others are, if you will, wetland type ecosystem related to sanitation and flood protection. And we've demonstrated the very important impacts in there. Right now, as we're headed towards the COP on biodiversity, and with the increased attention of the important role of cities in climate action, both on mitigation and adaptation, I think you're having a little bit of a good alignment of stars that is drawing much more attention to nature-based solutions. But I think the other challenge, which is the political economy considerations, is a bit of a bigger problem. I mean, think about it. When you're a mayor, ribbon cutting of a grey infrastructure, a new sewage treatment plant, a new water filtration system, a new newly paved road, with its visible impact probably avails itself as a much more ribbon cutting opportunity than, if you will, the preservation of an existing park against the encroachment, the improvement or the introduction of a few open spaces for flood retention, etc. So I think there is still a culture in certain places where, if you will, the more concrete you pour, if you will, the more laudable impact you'll get, in terms of re-election. So, I mean, there's a few political economy constraints in there that don't make nature-based solutions like, preserving a park, reforesting an area, ensuring that mangroves and wetlands are protected. Now, when they get done and they get done well, you see a tremendous amount of impact on the city. And I can share with you a few examples on these, on a variety of cities that have really went to introducing these options, and suddenly the impact in terms of livability, in terms of, appreciation by the population has been immense. I mean, I spoke about the Chongqing stream in Seoul, but I mean, it's not just something that richer cities like Seoul and Singapore do. I mean, there are other cities, at different levels of economic development that have done, fascinating nature-based solutions. So one of our projects in the city of Colombo in Sri Lanka basically totally revalorized the a wetland called Bedangana. So it's a wetland and an environmental park, and we've basically protected the area. We've cleaned up the pollution, introduced, if you will, the few amenities, and you know, basically ensured the protection and even the expansion of the area. And the results have been immense. I mean, it has become a fascinating environmental park in the city, a major amenity with a very important improvement in the quality of life. It has improved the property values for all the neighboring properties, so has had a tangible economic impact on the population. It has reduced the flooding risk within the city. It has reduced upstream pollution. So therefore, if you will, the downstream water and replenishment of the reservoirs has also improved. So it has had health impacts, environmental impacts, livability impacts, and economic impacts on the population. We've done something like that also at the different levels of economic development in the city of Beira in Mozambique, where initially we started with a project that was tackling a major flooding problem. Beira is one of the five most exposed cities in the world to the impacts of climate change, because practically the totality of the city is below sea level, and sea level rise is expected with its models to really impact the city. So we started by tackling a flood protection project, and we've put, if you will, the gray infrastructure first, the flood channels. We've also tackled even a solid waste problem, because garbage blocks the flood channels and compounds the flooding problem. But then we combine this investment with a very important 17-kilometer linear park on the margins of the river, which is basically it serves as a flood retention area and a major linear green lung within the city. And the combination of those two investments have totally transformed the city, and at the same time rendered tremendous benefits in terms of reducing micro temperatures, reducing the flooding effect, etc. So it's not something that only, if you want, rich cities around the world do, but it's cities of various levels of economic development and to great impact as well.
Thank you very much, Sami. That was very enlightening, of course, and good to know that it's not just up to the rich cities, but such solutions can also be implemented in cities from the global south. Those are the ones which are facing huge challenges due to urbanization. What advice would you give to cities or municipalities which are trying to adopt nature-based solutions? Is there a step-by-step plan which you would advise them? Do you ask them to look at one particular challenge? And maybe also together with it, you can maybe share, is it only up to the cities or municipal bodies to adopt or to advance these solutions, or can also citizens or businesses contribute to that?
Thanks, Kanishka. I think when, let's say a city or a mayor wants to start thinking about nature-based solutions, I think it's important, one, to understand their existing situation, and two, to put in place a planning process that will allow them to tackle these types of issues based on, an understanding of the problems they face and how they may want to face them. So an understanding of, if you will, the natural assets that they have, whether, they're green or blue assets, and what needs to be valorized and for what purposes would be particularly important first steps. And a second step would be to, rethink their planning process, their spatial plan, in terms of A, the urban expansion of the city. I mean, to what extent is the city sprawling, which is obviously not good, both in terms of the conversion of, whether it's agricultural land or unbuilt land into urban areas, but it also leads to much more transit, much more carbon emissions, greenhouse gas emissions throughout the city. So being able to rethink, if you will, the compactness of the city, the integration between land use and transport, etc., to create a city where there is better mobility, but at the same time, less, if you will, depletion of their natural assets. So thinking in terms of the planning process, and you think at two scales, one at a citywide scale, including the metropolitan region, because some of those green and blue assets might be at the peri-urban fringe. But you also start thinking at a micro scale, at the neighborhood level, what you might want to call as tactical urbanism, you know, the small pocket parks, insertions, et cetera, that you may want to introduce to create smaller parks, tree cover, gardens, et cetera. And it gets us to thinking that obviously it's not just down to the city to think. I mean, there are, of course, citywide assets. You know, I mean, you're not going to be a group of citizens to think about something like a central park, you know, but, you know, your small neighborhood park, you know, a community group or a group of citizens can come and can invest in it. You've got lots of, you know, citizen work on issues related to urban agriculture, to tree planting, to, if you will, transformation of roofs into much more green cover, etc. So there are solutions that pertain to cities, that pertain to businesses. And then, of course, there's an articulation between cities and businesses on the one hand and the authorities on the other hand. I mean, because if it weren't for, you know, the authorities and local governments and the mayors understanding the importance of these green and blue assets for the livability, for the physical and mental well-being of the population, I mean, if they don't understand that this is a priority for the citizens and for the businesses, and that by doing so, you make the city more livable. And when you make a city more livable, it becomes more attractive for, if you will, that new footloose population, for businesses, for entrepreneurs, and it retains the talent that is in there. I mean, in this day and age, with each one of us working from home, I mean, really what ties you to a city is much more the amenities, the culture, the diversity, the inclusion, you know, especially if we continue like this, you know, not going per se physically to the office. So I think these are important dimensions to help make those nature-based solutions take off.
So the message I'm getting is that nature-based solutions are not only important for building urban resilience, but also to make cities livable. Yeah, I mean, thank you for also sharing all the solutions. As you rightly said, I think the pandemic has offered us an opportunity also to the cities to implement these solutions as part of their greener recovery and inclusive recovery plans. But also the COP26, which is happening soon, does help us bringing these messages to the cities, to the city leaders, and raising awareness about nature-based solutions so that, you know, eventually they do get implemented in cities or adopted in cities. Any last thoughts before we conclude?
I hope, you know, this conversation, you know, will help us spread the word a little bit about how nature-based solutions really can be both transformative for cities, but also, if you will, be much more efficient, cost-effective, and produce much better outcome. And not just environmental outcomes, but social outcomes. I mean, like we were discussing with Vivian, I mean, the impact in terms of, you know, ensuring the equity of access to public spaces, to green spaces, to blue spaces, their protection has far more reaching implications on, if you will, the poor than on anyone else. And obviously, as we've mentioned multiple times, I mean, a city which manages to retain and valorize its blue and green assets and to improve its livability becomes also a much more attractive city for, you know, the creative talent, which, again, you know, are not just part of what makes cities much more interesting to live in, but also, you know, enhances the competitiveness of cities. I mean, you know, cities that are at the forefront of, you know, the cultural and creative industries are also cities that people want to visit, want to live in, etc. So lots of benefits. Thank you for the conversation. Enjoyed it very much and look forward to talking to you again.